This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. You're hearing more and more about a trend on college campuses today, students rising up in protest against supposed racism, systemic hatred, microaggressions. Is what they're doing actually going to solve problems, or is it actually creating more problems than it solves? The Paris attacks have raised questions about the flood of refugees coming into Europe and the tens of thousands of refugees that President Obama says he'd like to admit into the United States. How many of these people are terrorists? There were some involved in the Paris attacks who came from Syria. And while the U.S. administration insists that we can vet these refugees to prevent anything similar happening here, we're going to look at the facts that show otherwise. How many drug prescriptions do you take? Did you know that at least 70% of Americans take one drug prescription and 50% take at least two? We're going to talk to Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about some stunning facts regarding the pharmaceutical industry that just might have you wondering whether you can trust these drugs. And finally, we'll finish the program by talking about how to avoid being offended. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Last week at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, a student group called Hidden Doors staged a protest. A couple hundred students demonstrated. They complained about microaggressions on campus. They made demands about what the school needed to be doing to eliminate racism on campus. A day after the protest, a black bag was found on the front steps of the Bishop Joseph Johnson Black Cultural Center on campus, and there was poop in the bag. The group that organized the protest was outraged. They called it a racist act. They wrote this in a Facebook post. The Hidden Doors team is appalled to announce that our demonstration yesterday was met this morning with a vile act. This morning, someone left a bag of feces on the porch of Vanderbilt University's Black Cultural Center. As many of us sit in grief, recognize that these types of actions are what we speak of when we note the reality of exclusion and isolation of students of color, and specifically black students, on our campus. This act has hurt many and will not be received lightly. We will not allow for the desecration of the place we call home. As we announced yesterday and affirm today, we will not be silent. Well, the campus police sprang into action, and by that night, they found the offender. Security cameras found that it was a blind female student. Her seeing eye dog did its business. She cleaned it up. She couldn't find a trash can, so she did what she had been instructed to do. She left it outside the door rather than taking it inside so that the next person coming along could put it in the trash. She posted this on Facebook after getting a visit from the campus police. "Everyone is going to point me out now as the blind girl who left her dog feces by the Black Cultural Center. I am sorry that I don't know where all the trash cans are on main campus." There was no hate crime. This was not evidence of racism. You had students who were sitting in grief, who were hurting because of a hate crime that they invented. They were ready to charge to the barricades over nothing. How many of these kinds of incidents would it take before these types of student groups acknowledge that their thinking is wrong, that their thinking is off base? We're in a climate of prosecuting microaggressions, treating everything as evidence of hate and racism. How many improperly disposed of bags of feces are being trumped up into a cause for war? We recently talked about the serious crisis at Yale University, this dangerous incident that caused many students to feel unsafe, to feel like what was once a sanctuary and a refuge is now hostile to them, that they're under attack. Several students have said they cannot bear to live in the college anymore. One resident wrote on the campus publication, "I have friends who are not going to class, who are not doing their homework, who are losing sleep, who are skipping meals, and who are having breakdowns." Well, what was it that caused such distress and anguish for these poor students? It started when the dean at Yale sent an email to all undergraduates telling them to be careful not to offend people with Halloween costumes. He wasn't talking about avoiding sexually suggestive costumes or grotesque costumes. He was talking about culturally insensitive costumes like feathered headdresses, turbans, war paint, and blackface. He said he hoped students would actively avoid those circumstances that threaten our sense of community. And after he wrote that email, another school official sent a follow-up email that said basically, is it really the job of university officials to decide these things? Don't we trust the students enough to allow them to make decisions about what they wear? Do we have to be so concerned about costumes that might offend? When students read the second email, they were outraged. They accused her of saying that it's okay to dress like an Indian or a Muslim for a Halloween. Doesn't she realize how outrageous that is? Her husband, who is also an official at the college, he spoke with students trying to hear them out, and he was standing by the position that they had to protect freedom of speech. And the students shouted him down and demanded that he and his wife both be fired. This is what The Atlantic wrote about the incident. These are young people who live in safe, heated buildings with two Steinway grand pianos, an indoor basketball court, a courtyard with hammocks and picnic tables, a computer lab, a dance studio, a gym, a movie theater, a film editing lab, billiard tables, an art gallery, and four music practice rooms. But they can't bear this setting that millions of people would risk their lives to inhabit because one woman wrote an email that hurt their feelings. This is what the best and brightest in America's highest universities are being taught to think. They're being trained in how to be offended, trained to recognize aggression in things where there is no aggression. And this isn't just funny. It's not just ridiculous. It really is a serious problem because we're getting a look at America's future. It's the nation's educational system that turns out tomorrow's leaders. And these young people are radical. These are extremely divisive and dangerous ideas of what justice looks like and what society owes them and how they should be treated and how they should be able to shut down anyone who disagrees with them or makes them feel uncomfortable in the least. And they're gaining more and more power. And they have the backing of, and they're in step with the thinking of, a lot of government officials who came out of the same educational system. Last week, we finished the January 2016 issue of the Trumpet magazine, and the cover story by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury is called "The Roots of America's Dangerous Turn Left." It's a fantastic story in this issue. It'll be up on thetrumpet.com soon. In the 1960s and 70s, the article describes the problems on college campuses and how the new left began to get into those institutions and to gain control. The new left, the article reads, was a powerful political movement that swept through the nations in the 1960s and 1970s. Agitators and educators worked to bring about changes in homosexual rights, abortion, gender roles, drugs, and other issues. The movement was closely tied to the hippie movement, and it achieved many of its lawless goals. It says the champions of the movement had stunning success in working their way into key positions in today's Democratic Party. This article also says it was in the education system that the left got its foothold into the nation, first in colleges, then high schools, and even elementary schools. It is from the education system that a nation gets its leadership. Where did the ideas of America's leaders today come from? From our educational institutions. And this article shows the connections of the new left to enemies outside the U.S. who were using this group to infiltrate America and to create serious problems. This is a really important article to read, The Roots of America's Dangerous Turn Left. You can find it in the January 2016 edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine. But look what is happening here. This notion that these groups are going to bring justice by manufacturing racial grievance is extremely dangerous. What's happening here is going to create problems far worse than whatever problems they purport to solve. In fact, it's creating blatant racism, overt hatred, actual conflict by obsessing over microaggressions. It is inflating problems into actual aggressions. I want to just read a paragraph from Brett Stevens' most recent article. This was a column in the Wall Street Journal from this past Monday. The title, Radical Parents, Despotic Children. This is what he says. For almost 50 years, universities have adopted racialist policies in the name of equality, repressive speech codes in the name of tolerance, ideological orthodoxy in the name of intellectual freedom. Sooner or later, Orwellian methods will lead to Orwellian outcomes. Those coddled, bullying undergrads, shouting their demands for safer spaces, easier classes, and additional racial set-asides, are exactly what the campus faculty and administrators deserve. In other words, the radical children who grew up to run the universities have duplicated the achievement of their parents and taken it a step further. In three generations, the campuses have moved from indulgent liberalism to destructive radicalism to the raised fist racialism of the present. And we have to understand that the kind of justice these students are demanding does not exist. It doesn't exist. There would never be a point where everyone could live in perfect conformity with their expectations, because the way they define things like racism and microaggression and white privilege, anything they decide is an indication of the problem. Anything that they decide is evidence of the problem that they're trying to expose, and they themselves are immune from having to abide by standards of civility and decency. They themselves, the way they define racism, are inherently incapable of being racist. And if they say that something is racist or that something makes them feel unsafe, then everyone is expected to play along, to fold up, to act that like this is perfectly legitimate. They're supposed to give in to any demands of these students. And no matter how bizarre or off the wall their demands are, if someone fails to agree 100% with them, that in itself is considered evidence of racism. And meanwhile, no evidence to the contrary to their view is considered proof enough that they're wrong. The fact that Americans elected a black president twice, the fact that the number two Republican candidate is black, that he has the support of some of the most conservative members of that party, the ones that I'm sure people would consider the most racist. Who are the people supporting this man if they're so racist? Here's some evidence of a backlash now among whites at these college campuses in the U.S., backlash against these incidents that we're saying. This is a Washington Post article from November 20th, last Friday. It says a Facebook page ostensibly created for an audience at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign called Illini White Students Union has drawn fire after it characterized the national Black Lives Matter movement as terrorism. Created Wednesday after a protest sympathetic to Black Lives Matter, the page declared itself, quote, for white students of University of Illinois to be able to form a community and discuss our own issues, as well as be able to organize against the terrorism we have been facing from Black Lives Matter activists on campus. This according to the Daily Illini. The About section of their webpage is dedicated to white pride and a safe place for white students, according to the News Gazette, although that page appeared to have changed. This website from this white student union said this: feel free to send in pictures you take of any black protesters on the quad so we know who anti-whites are, one message read as Fox 55 reported. According to a student reporter, protesters were particularly concerned that they were being targeted. Is it possible? I would say it's possible. The collegefix.com actually found, looking into this over the weekend, over the last week, at least 33 other white student union pages have appeared on Facebook, according to research conducted Sunday by the College Fix. Notably, white student union Facebook pages have been created for Stanford, Penn State, UCLA, UC Berkeley, the University of Missouri, and NYU, along with many others. It talks about commonalities among these pages. Many share a copy and paste-like description in the About section. Word choices in the descriptions are largely identical. One common description states, a safe space to support and promote the interests of students of European descent at this university, whatever the relevant university name is. A longer description found on several of the pages states, we affirm the dignity and ancestry of our proud people who have gifted the world with countless works of beauty, science, and wisdom, and are committed to promoting a dialogue and political resistance that will secure a future for our posterity and spirit. At the same time, we do not wish to denigrate or harm any other group or ethnicity. Here's one more paragraph from this College Fix article. In their timeline, some pages post news articles critical of the Black Lives Matter movement or stories that aim to debunk white privilege. Posts on these pages also include articles on racial controversies at other campuses or their own. Additional posts are on topics such as Europe and the European refugee crisis, political correctness, links to other white student union pages, and any articles written about themselves or other white student union pages. This is inevitable. Here are students who are being pushed and pushed and pushed, these student groups that are pushing and pushing and pushing and making accusations and making demands and forcing changes according to their view of justice. And it's stirring things up. And I'm sure among those whom it is stirring up are some who are racist. And this could all blow up in our faces. Obviously, there is racism in America. There are racist people who will do racist things. But the idea that these student groups who are demanding racial justice, that what they're doing is going to root out this supposedly systemic racism, this racism that the president has said is in our DNA as a nation, this is dangerously wrong. And it's leading in exactly the opposite direction. This misguided pursuit of justice that has no actual solution, no end other than simply accusing and maligning and protesting and raising Cain and getting people fired and causing a ruckus and exposing what is supposedly a huge systemic problem, supposedly aimed at eliminating racism, it is stirring it up. It's stirring it up more and more, and it's deeply concerning, as we've mentioned several times at the Trumpet, because of biblical prophecies that show race problems in the United States that they're going to explode, and they're going to explode on a scale that we really have difficulty imagining at this point. Although in watching these stories unfold, it's becoming less difficult to imagine, but it's going to hurt all of us of every race. We're all going to suffer because of what is unfolding here. In the last word segment on today's program, I want to talk about this culture of taking offense. I want to show why it's so destructive, why it will never have positive results. It's because it breaks the law, and that always creates problems. But I wanted to close with this thought from Brett Stevens. He mentioned a possible solution for the problems in our universities. He said a better way might be to found great new universities, as John D. Rockefeller did with the University of Chicago, or Andrew Carnegie did with the Carnegie Technical Schools, later Carnegie Mellon, in Pittsburgh. Is there an Adelson or a Gates or a Walton University to be started along similar lines, perhaps on the campuses of colleges that have recently closed their doors? It would help, too, if these new schools adopted the model of Hillsdale College in Michigan, where there are no protests, by refusing to accept federal subsidies, thus relieving them of the strictures and mandates by which the government enforces political correctness. Hillsdale College is a very conservative college, and I'm sure that it's one of the schools that is many people would look at and accuse of elitism, that they would say that this is a bastion of white privilege. But Hillsdale College is a school that teaches respect for law. They teach classes on the Constitution. They have produced videos that they make freely available to the public that discuss the founding principles of the United States of America, that advocate law-keeping, that advocate the separation of powers and the constitutional restraints on the government that the Constitution imposes. And there are no protests there. The students aren't out demonstrating, and they're not inventing grievances, and they're not complaining of endemic problems with the system. The fruits of that education are good. Schools that teach liberal lawlessness are the ones with the biggest problems, and it's not because they haven't implemented their politically correct policies enough. It's not because we're all so much more racist now. It's because they're bad policies. It's because their policies are failing. It's because their worldview is flawed. It's because their thinking is off base. Brett Stevens says this in his article, "That's why I'm not altogether sorry to see the wave of protests, demands, sit-ins, and cave-ins sweeping university campuses from Dartmouth to Princeton to Brandeis to Yale. What destroys also exposes. What they are trashing was already trashy. It's time for the rest of the country to sit up and take notice." Any school that teaches respect for law, any school that teaches personal accountability, personal responsibility, rather than victim culture, rather than finger pointing, that school isn't going to have protests. They're not going to have dissatisfied student bodies. Students aren't going to be whining about how hard they have it. They're not going to assume that a bag of dog waste that wasn't put in a trash receptacle is evidence of racial hatred. Can we accept that? Can we look honestly at what's going on here? Can we see it for what it is? Can we recognize the truth that has been exposed in these protests and in the problems that are plaguing university campuses today? Can we see it for what it is, take some wisdom from it, and accept the truth?
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
the flood of millions of refugees from Syria was already creating a political crisis in Europe as nations struggled to figure out how to stem the flow. But then the terrorist attack in Paris happened just a week or so ago, killing about 130 people. It was really only a matter of time before something like this happened. There were warnings that the Islamic State was sending terrorists into Europe in the midst of all these refugees. Warnings had surfaced that there were actually a lot of such terrorists. Now it looks like those warnings were accurate. Well, now in the United States, President Obama is saying that he wants to accept tens of thousands of Syrian immigrants into this country. He has ridiculed anyone who says that they're concerned this will bring terrorists in here, that the U.S. could experience exactly what Paris is dealing with right now. Is that fear unfounded? We're going to look at the evidence. I have trumpet writer Anthony Chibadewe with me. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Mr. Helica.
First of all, let's just talk about what the Islamic State themselves are saying about the threat that they pose.
Following the attack that they managed to pull up in France a couple of weeks ago, the Islamic State produced a video where they were actually threatening that Washington, D.C. would be the next target. Now, senior law enforcement authorities told this to the news media last week, and it was pretty much around that time that the FBI's director, James Comey, came out and told the United States that they have dozens of people that are under tight surveillance here in the United States. So they are watching these dozens of people. They believe that they are likely to conduct copycat versions of the Paris attacks here in Washington, D.C. So they are watching those dozens. The FBI, of course, didn't tell us who those dozens are, and we obviously don't know who those dozens are. But we do know that there are a couple of thousands of Syrian refugees who have come into the United States, and we know that the Obama administration is planning to bring in a lot more than that, thousands more than that. And we are bringing in these Syrian refugees, but we don't know who they are. We don't know what their background is. We have not been able to vet them, even though there has been talk about vetting these Syrians who do get to come to the United States, but it's actually absolutely impossible to vet these people. So this is the problem that we have here in the United States.
Before we even talk about the ones who might be coming into the country anymore, it has been shown that there were nearly 70 Islamic State-linked plotters in the United States who've been arrested over the last year and a half. And some of them were refugees who were given entry into the United States by American authorities.
That's a very, very concerning stat that you brought out. 70 people who have been arrested in the United States. Now, some people might want to look at those numbers and just say that these are just American citizens who have always been here. These are not refugees, or even if they do consider that there may be refugees among the group, but still, here's the main point. Even if it's just a group of entirely American citizens, what does this mean? It means that the Islamic State has that much influence on American citizen. How much more influence will it have on Syrian refugees who are being accepted into the United States? And we do know that this number actually does include Syrian refugees. So that's a very worrying development right there.
Could you just tell us about this Pew Research Center poll? You talk about the influence that the Islamic State has. And I think, you know, the rhetoric that you hear coming out of Washington is, you know, we've contained the threat. It's not that important. This is a JV squad, that type of thing. It's not that big of a concern. But Pew found differently.
Yes, it did. They had research recently that shows that there is a significant amount of support among people for the Islamic State within the Muslim world. up to 14% of the population has a favorable opinion of the Islamic State. That's within 11 representative nation states. And upwards of 62% don't know whether they have a favorable opinion of the Islamic State or not. So they are 62% who are undecided about this. And as the research indicates, those 62% are likely supportive of the Islamic State.
Right. Anybody who watches what the Islamic State is doing and says, well, I'm not sure whether I support them or not, something is seriously wrong here. If you don't absolutely condemn the killing of Christians and killing of children and setting people on fire and drowning them in cages and beheading them, something is really wrong here.
It is really wrong. And one thing to really emphasize here is that the Islamic State doesn't really need too many people to help their cause. They just need just a small percentage. A small percentage can do great harm. Just look at what happened in Paris. Now, here we have this research that says 14% are in full support of the Islamic State, and then you have 62% who are not decided.
So what kind of numbers are we talking about? This is 11 nation states. The populations of 11 nation states, assuming this polling information is accurate, 14% support. What sort of population are we talking about?
Yes. The total populations of these nation states is something like about 400 or so million people. And if we are talking of 62%, we are talking about 287 million people. 287 people who are not sure exactly who they are supporting, whether they like ISIS or not. So these are really, really significant numbers we are talking about here.
And among the, say, you said 14% say we do have a favorable opinion. 14% of that number would be?
So for these 11 nation states of about 400 million people, we have 14%, which would be about 63 million ISIS supporters within those states. 63 million. And how many were involved in the Paris attacks? We know specifically of about 8 people who were directly involved in this. But now we're talking about 63 million people, not to mention 287 million who are undecided whether they will support the cause of the Islamic State. So those are really disturbing numbers. And as we mentioned earlier, we do not have a process of vetting these people. When they come in and we are planning to bring in more of them, there already is evidence that those involved in the Paris attacks had some association with Islamic State, and they had visited Syria and the Islamic State, working for the Islamic State in Syria, and they did manage to go back into Europe. So this is a very disturbing development.
Yeah, if you have 63 million Islamic State supporters in 11 countries, if you have, what, a tenth of 1%, that would be 6,300 terrorists. That's quite an army when you, like you said, when you consider how much 8 people can do, or a dozen people, or 20 people can do. 6,300 is a lot.
And another thing to consider as well is that a lot of these people are fairly young people. And it's quite a contrast with organizations like Al-Qaeda. The Islamic State has a greater advantage because it can influence a lot of these young people. Some people are under the impression that younger people, they are not as radical. But studies in Europe have actually shown that it's the younger people who are even more radical, who are even more susceptible to the influence of the Islamic State.
I just want to read a quote from an article about the Syrian ambassador to India, Riyad Abbas. Said that among the refugees who went to Europe, maybe more than 20% belong to ISIL groups. Now Europe has received bad elements into their ground. They face further problems in the future. And he was referring to the terrorist attacks on November 13th. 20%, according to this guy. I mean, even if he's close to correct, this is a massive, massive problem. And then you have this Dr. Mudar Zahran, a Muslim refugee living in the United Kingdom. He called what is happening here the Islamic conquest of the West. He said, I have to be honest, you read Arab magazines and Arab newspapers, they're talking about good job, now we're going to conquest Europe, so it's not even a secret. That's a really troubling sign. I mean, all of these politicians, Francois Hollande, who says that this is a war, that we're going to wage war mercilessly against this enemy. Really, you have to wonder, are they serious about this? Because there's no question about the Islamic State's seriousness. They are serious. But how much action are European nations actually willing to take? And the United States, it seems like the leaders in this country have a pretty strong determination to not take action against this.
The doctor you mentioned, Dr. Zahran, he also mentioned the religious element in this situation. This is actually a religious doctrine. It's called the Hijra, I believe that's how it's pronounced, or a migration or a journey where they conquer, essentially they conquer a nation by migrating to that nation. That's the first part of this Hijra. And this doctor say that Muslims, what Muslims are doing now, they couldn't do it in the last 20 years. And now the West is doing that for us, for free, and even paying for it. So you have these Muslims who are following their religious beliefs, they are traveling, migrating into Europe in numbers, in huge numbers, and they are causing havoc in Europe. So there's a religious element to it, and we do know that definitely Europe is going to do something about that because it's literally overwhelmed by this scourge.
Well, thanks for bringing this information to our attention, Anthony. We appreciate it. It's a story I'm sure it's just going to keep on growing, and it definitely has ramifications far beyond Europe. We'll talk to you again more about it, I'm sure. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Drugs are big business. That's certainly true of illegal drugs that are empowering drug cartels in Mexico and elsewhere, but it's even more true of legal drugs. No nation on earth is such a massive consumer of medications as the United States. How many medications are you on? Many people take literally dozens of prescriptions. And then you have issues with drug combining and the problems that result from that. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques has some astonishing facts about this industry, and some of it is pretty alarming. Jeremiah, how are you doing?
Doing really well.
Let's start by just talking about the scale of this industry. How many people are using prescription drugs in the U.S. right now?
Well, the scale is really staggering. Right now, there are almost 70% of Americans taking at least one prescription drug, and over half of Americans are taking at least two. But I think what is even more astonishing is a smaller percentage of Americans who are taking numerous prescriptions. Like you said, it's dozens in many cases. In fact, in 2014, Americans were written a total of 4.3 billion, with a B, total prescriptions. So for a population of only 319 million, that number is just staggering. That pulls the average number of prescriptions per person up to about 13.5.
Average. The average person is taking 13.5 prescriptions.
Yeah, that's the average. And with each passing year, these numbers are climbing. And they're just growing, making the pharmaceutical industry ever larger and ever more powerful.
So how much money is involved? Do you have any idea what the scale of the size of the industry is?
Yes, it is. It's a billion-dollar industry. In 2013, the total drug spending was $3.29.2 billion. That's according to IMS, Institute for Healthcare Informatics. So that comes to about $1,000 per person.
So just considering the wealth involved, the wealth creation, and the amount of power that would tend to accompany that, what are some of the problems associated with the pharmaceutical industry? Just looking at the influence that they have, or even the partnership with the medical community.
Well, there are some very real risks, even if you just focus on the actual health, the health risks presented to those who are taking these drugs. About 16% of all hospital admissions are related to adverse reactions to prescription drugs being taken as prescribed.
So they're told this is the drug that you need to take. They do it exactly the way they're told to do it, and they have to be admitted to the hospital for the results of that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And women are at particularly high risk because very often prescription drugs are only ever tested on men. So the FDA approves it, they put it on the market, and then women actually take more pharmaceuticals than men across the board. And so very often these are just not designed to work well with a woman's body. And so it ends up presenting all kinds of complications. And here is the very biggest number that really jumped out at me. That is that pharmaceuticals used as prescribed are the fourth leading cause of death for Americans. That puts it ahead of diabetes, ahead of car accidents, ahead of AIDS. It's a number 10 times larger than the number of people killed by illegal drugs.
Wow.
Yeah, so these are just really amazing risks, just high, very real risks.
So how big is the legal drug trade relative to the illegal drug trade?
Well, I don't have figures for that, but it looks like it's quite a bit larger. I mean, if 10 times as many people are dying, then it would be, just dwarfing the numbers of illegal drugs.
Yeah, well, I would certainly say that if 70% of Americans are on at least one prescription, 50% are on at least two prescriptions, that's certainly far higher than it would be people who are taking illegal drugs.
Yeah, that's right. Very few would want to break the law. But if their doctor's telling them, here, take this, this is going to make you feel like yourself again, then just about everyone will say, I trust this man. He's
right.
He's been trained. He's received a lot of education. He's concerned about my well-being. But in very many of these situations, it looks like that's not the case. And so I would encourage anyone who is being told to take a pharmaceutical to ask their doctor a few questions before they do. And the first of those questions is about a statistic called the NNT. The NNT, that stands for the number needed to treat. And this is a number that doctors don't want to talk about. Pharmaceutical companies really don't want to talk about it. But this describes the number of people who need to take a certain drug in order for one of them to be helped by it. So if you consider the example of statin, this is a class of drug routinely prescribed to lower cholesterol levels. But the NNT for the most widely prescribed statin is 250.
Wow.
So that means for every 250 people taking it, statin prevents only one person from having adverse effects. So, I mean, that's just a shocking number.
You mean the other people are getting, they're having side effects from taking the drug?
Well, side effects is a different statistic. That's actually another question that I believe anybody should ask. They should say, what percentage of people taking this drug are affected by side effects? With statin, if you stick to that example, it is about 5%. 5% of people have joint pain, muscle pain, gastrointestinal distress. In severe cases, they can have muscle breakdown and even type 2 diabetes because of taking statin. So if you do the math, if you add the side effects percentage, 5%, to that NNT, then you see that for every 250 people taking statin, one is helped, and more than a dozen suffer these awful side effects.
Well, you know, it's I would think that there are probably a lot of people who would say, I'll take the odds if only 5% of the people are actually actually adversely affected by it. But you're saying one out of 250 people is actually helped by it. Is that what I'm understanding?
That's right. One out of 250 is helped and 12.5 are adversely affected. Hmm. So the vast majority have no real effect from it. Something like 230 or so. But yeah, those numbers, if people were told these numbers in black and white terms like this, I think far fewer would just blithely accept a recommendation to take all these pharmaceuticals.
Well, even the statistic alone that there are just the high rates of problems associated with doing exactly what you're told. You have something wrong with you, you go to the hospital, you say, I need something for this. The doctor says, here you go, take this drug. You take it exactly the way that he said in order to supposedly solve this problem, and you end up with a problem that's far worse because of the drug that you took. That in and of itself, the fourth leading cause of death in the United States, should give people pause, I would think.
It really should. It really should. But these facts are very seldom discussed, and so most people just assume that they're taking the best course of action, and they say, there are risks, there may be complications, but this is still the best course of action. But I believe in a lot of cases, that's not true.
So I was talking to a friend of mine who's a pharmacist. She was saying that the people who come into her and give her prescriptions, they say, you know, I need you to fill this prescription. There are a lot of times where she looks at this and she'll ask them, well, tell me what else you're taking. And she'll find out that they're on a dozen medications or that type of thing. And she understands some of the complications that can arise from combining this drug with that drug. So she'll actually remove drugs off of their list of prescriptions and say, you know, let's simplify this. Let's get this down. There are times when she's actually calling up a doctor and saying, it's really irresponsible to give this drug when this person is already taking, you know, B, C, and D drugs. Or you know, saying there's another drug, or here's an alternative that's a healthful, you know, a natural alternative to treating this particular problem. But the doctor basically he has the handful of drugs that he tends to prescribe just as a matter of routine. Maybe he's familiar with 5 or 10 or 15 drugs, and he's just going to go to kind of the next closest thing that tends to deal with that particular problem without necessarily paying attention to the ramifications that it might have with this individual?
Yes, that's right. And I think very often, as you said, it is that the doctor is familiar with it. It's a matter of routine. But what I've found is that in a lot of cases, they are actually being paid by pharmaceutical companies to push certain products. So it's not just a matter of habit. Anyone who watches TV knows that you can't really turn it on without being bombarded by, you know, stressed out women finally getting a good night's sleep and depressed teenagers undergoing a dramatic transformation to joyousness suddenly and, you know, silver-haired men regaining long-lost virility. But pharmaceutical companies actually spend only a fraction of their marketing money to target directly to consumers. The overwhelming majority of it, they're spending on targeting doctors. If you look at 2012, for example, pharmaceutical companies spent $3.5 billion on direct-to-consumer marketing. That same year, they spent $24 billion marketing to healthcare professionals. See, unlike the situation with most products, a consumer can't buy a pharmaceutical unless they have someone's permission. Mm-hmm. They have to have that doctor's permission. So the pharmaceutical companies know that, you know, doctors are really the only ones that have the power to move these products from their warehouses onto, you know, a patient's medicine cabinet shelf there. So the companies really channel the bulk of their marketing directly to healthcare professionals. And this is... it's just a blatant conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. If a doctor's pockets are being lined by these drug companies and, you know, they're being paid in all sorts of ways, from speaking fees, where they're encouraged to speak to other doctors, and they're paid $1,500 a talk, $3,000 a talk. Tell other doctors to use our drug. And also, the pharmaceutical companies have a way of getting data from the doctor's offices that they speak to. So they know, hey, you wrote 5 prescriptions for our drug last month, but you wrote 25 for the competitor's drug. What's going on with that? What about all that money we've been giving you? So just all across the board there are ways that the drug companies are buying doctors. So it just really seems like a very shady practice in a lot of ways. And just something that's happening in a really widespread manner.
So you mentioned a couple of questions that someone should ask if you are in a situation where you're getting a prescription for something. Are there other steps that a consumer might take in order to protect themselves? Apart from, well, how about we just stay away from the doctor?
Well, yeah, that's a big one. Our culture right now says if you have an ailment, you go to a doctor and get a drug to treat the symptoms. And in a lot of cases, a patient may receive some relief from some symptoms by getting these drugs. But I believe society would benefit massively from an overall shift away from that kind of thinking and toward preventative kind of thinking with healthcare, mm-hmm. Healthcare complications. Preventative thinking would be eat well, exercise well. And very often that's going to prevent a wide range of these problems before they ever come up.
Right. Yeah. We tend to want to live the way we want to live. And when problems arise because we're doing something that's unhealthy, then we just want a quick fix and we want to keep on doing what we're doing. But in reality, we have a lot of control or we have a lot of power over the state of our health. If we're taking care of ourselves right, then you're going to avoid a lot of the problems that end up putting a lot of people into the doctor's office.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's an instant gratification kind of a culture right now. And in that mindset, people don't like to hear, well, you know what? You need to get on an exercise regime. You need to make long-term dietary changes. Instead, they want to hear, here, pop 3 of these. You'll be fine.
Right. We've been talking with Jeremiah Jacques. He's working on an article. This is the working title at this point. The doc says you need to take those meds. Should you? Look for it on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for coming in, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
I'm the victim. You have offended me. That's the way more and more people in the world today are being taught to think. We live in a world of microaggressions and trigger words, a world where everyone needs sensitivity training to avoid offending other people around them. Is there anything wrong with this? I mean, the idea that we don't want to offend people, that's certainly not a bad idea. But this concept of victimization ignores the fact that we are responsible for how we respond to people. If somebody says something to you that you don't like, you choose your response. If somebody says something offensive, you can actually choose not to be offended. You can just as easily as get offended, give that person the benefit of the doubt. Well, he probably didn't intend it. Maybe he was thinking of something else. Maybe he didn't realize how he was coming across. We all have tough days. Maybe he had a headache. Any one of those ideas would prevent the kind of antagonism and problems that tend to result from being oversensitive and being touchy. I recently read the story of a man. He was a restaurant manager, very positive man. People would ask him, "How you doing, Jerry?" He'd say, "If I were any better, I would be twins." He was a really fantastic guy to work for. And someone asked him, "Well, how do you stay so positive?" He said, "Well, each morning I wake up and I tell myself, Jerry, you have 2 choices today. You can either be in a good mood or in a bad mood. I choose to be in a good mood. If something bad happens, I can either choose to be a victim or I can choose to learn from it. If somebody complains, I can accept those complaints or I can point out the positive. And the person said, yeah, right. It's not that easy. He said, yes, it is. Life is all about choices. When you cut away the junk, every situation is a choice. You choose how you react to situations. You choose how people will affect your mood. You choose to be in a good mood or a bad mood. That's the bottom line. It's your choice how you live your life. Well, years later, after that conversation, Jerry was working in his restaurant and he made the mistake of leaving the back door of the restaurant open. Any restaurant manager knows that's a no-no. Three armed robbers came into the restaurant. They held Jerry at gunpoint. As he was fumbling for the safe, he got a little bit nervous, and one of the armed robbers made the mistake of shooting him. Jerry lay on the floor, and he thought, I have a choice, to die or to live. I choose to live. The paramedics came to the restaurant, and they were working on him. They said, you know, he's going to be fine. They brought him on the ambulance, took him to the emergency room, wheeled him through the doors, and Jerry looked up and he saw the faces of the doctors, and he got scared. He could see in the eyes of these doctors, this guy is a dead man. And there was a big nurse there shouting questions at him, saying, are you allergic to anything? And Jerry summoned up his strength and said, yes. The doctors and the nurses all stopped working, and they waited for his reply. He took a deep breath, and he said, bullets! And they all burst out laughing. It was a very tense situation that was immediately broken by the way that Jerry responded in the situation. And he told the doctors, I am choosing to live. Operate on me as if I'm alive, not dead. Well, he did live, and a big part of the reason was because of his choice to live. How do you choose when someone offends you? Someone says something that could be taken as offensive, something that's insensitive, something that isn't well considered. Well, believe it or not, the law of God actually has some wisdom on this point. In the book of Leviticus, in the 19th chapter, there are a few verses here that just have some wonderful wisdom that prevent us from getting into troublesome situations with other people. Verse 17 of Leviticus 19 says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You know, Jesus Christ, when he was on this earth, he said that it was actually violating the spirit of the law against murder to hate someone. Well, you know, he did not invent that himself. It's right there enshrined within the law of the Old Testament. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. God actually cares about what you think of other people. Even if you don't say anything negative about them, God's law forbids hatred in your heart. Are you judgmental and critical of other people? Do you hold grudges against people? We're talking about the spirit of God's law. This is a spirit of the law that has always existed. God has always been concerned about what happens within your heart, and it's always been against hatred. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. God wants our hearts to be full of love for people, not hate. It says, you shall in any wise rebuke your neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. You shall not avenge. If you happen to feel like somebody does something wrong to you, don't take vengeance. Don't retaliate. Don't lash back at them. And then it says, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people. But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Eternal. Did you know that the law of God forbids us to even bear grudges? Again, this is about what's going on in your heart. That phrase, bear a grudge, means to cherish anger or hold on to feelings of ill will God commands that we not bear a grudge. Even if we feel like we've been done wrong by, we have to be willing to let it go. And it's all about that principle enshrined at the end of verse 18. But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. How do you want to be treated? You don't want people being oversensitive around you, judging you, harboring bitterness against you, holding grudges, assuming the worst about you. You appreciate it when they believe the best about you. You don't have to walk on eggshells around them. You know that they can see past your imperfections. They give you the benefit of the doubt. Obviously, we all need to exercise social graces and proper etiquette around each other. But we also want to feel like we're free to be ourselves and that people accept us and appreciate us for who we are and that they love us in spite of our flaws. That's exactly the kind of kindness toward others that we need to demonstrate. There's a wonderful truth contained in Psalm 119 and verse 165. It says, "Great peace have they which love your law, and nothing shall offend them." This is how to avoid being offended. This is how to not get worked up over petty things. This is how to have peace in your relationships, peace in your mind, peace in your heart. Love God's law. Love that wonderful law of love, God's wonderful, precious law of love, and nothing will offend you. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories like what we talked about on this program. That's where you can go to get a free subscription to the monthly news magazine, the Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. You can send us comments or questions by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Anthony Chibadirwe and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Monson. Never let a problem to be solved become more important than a person to be loved. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.